Happy New Year, everyone. The Brian Lehrer Show is on tape today, so we won't be taking your phone calls. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. With growing attention to the apparent fact that Russia hacked the emails of the Democratic Party and Clinton campaign chair John Podesta, here's a question about journalism. Should news organizations refuse to publish leaked information if it comes from a foreign country trying to influence our elections? In the Times, long article on the hacks yesterday, one line said, quote, every major publication, including the Times, published multiple stories citing DNC and Podesta emails posted by WikiLeaks, becoming a de facto instrument of Russian intelligence. Neera Tanden, Clinton ally and president of the Center for American Progress, was among those whose emails were published. She told the Times for their article, what was really surprising to me, I could not believe that reporters were covering it. So let's take on that question. Should news organizations refuse to publish leaked information if it comes from a foreign country trying to influence our elections? Eric Lipton, one of the Times reporters with a byline on yesterday's article called Hacking the Democrats, joins us. And also with us is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David and Eric. Thanks so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to join you.
Thank you.
Eric, that's a heavy thing to write in the Times, that every major publication, including the Times, became a de facto instrument of Russian intelligence. Do you feel like the Times and the American media in general were played?
I think that it's a difficult question that doesn't have a simple answer, and I think that at minimum it's something that newspapers need to be discussing and coming up with the better answers to. And I realize that I didn't really answer your question, but I could give you a longer one.
So, well, go ahead. You want to give me another layer on that?
I mean, it's basically a tension between two imperatives. The first imperative is to report news that has news value, and the second is to not become an accomplice to a crime. And so the problem is when you're faced with a situation in which, you know, I could certainly illustrate it with the Sony hack, which is another very similar situation. North Korea had hacked into the Sony email and computer system after a film that disturbed the leadership in North Korea. That was a mock film suggesting that literally assassinating the leader of North Korea, and then they hacked into the system there. After that, I saw emails that had come out of Sony that showed that the film executives were collectively working to try to influence the Mississippi State Attorney General to try to get him to do subpoenas and to investigate Google because it was not doing enough to crack down on sort of bootlegging of movies that were on the internet. And that was really interesting because they were talking about making contributions to the Mississippi Attorney General to try to influence him, and they actually drafted a subpoena that they wanted him to send to Google to get information from Google as they were trying to go after Google because they thought it was essentially allowing their intellectual property to be stolen. So that was fascinating, and it seemed like that was really important. But at the New York Times, we were like, well, we're not going to use the Sony emails because they were stolen by a foreign government as a way to try to humiliate Sony. And so what do you do in that situation? I mean, there's the film industry was trying to use its clout to influence, and they'd hired the former Mississippi Attorney General to lobby his successor, and they were making contributions to the Mississippi Attorney General, and they'd written a draft subpoena for him. And then he issued that subpoena to Google. So, wow, how do we not write that?
And you did or did not write that?
I did. I wrote that story.
Yeah.
Even though the New York Times policy at that point was we should stay away from using the Sony emails. So what we did in that situation was we tried not to quote from the emails, but we relied upon the content. Now, that was pretty substantive. Some of the stuff in the Clinton emails, the Podesta emails, that is, were really, I mean, there was some gossipy stuff that I don't think you can justify doing gossipy stuff. There was the text of the speeches she gave to the Wall Street banks that made headlines. I mean, you know, can you justify that? I don't know. I mean, but can you justify any of it? I don't really know the answer to this. I think it's a really difficult question.
So, David, I'll turn to you, but I also want to open up the phones for listeners. And in this case, invite journalists in particular on this question. Should news organizations refuse to publish leaked information if it comes from a foreign country trying to influence our elections or government policies? Or Eric Clifton from The Times just gave the example of the Sony emails, which adds another wrinkle. Should news organizations ever refuse to publish information they consider to be in the public interest because the source was too tainted in any way? 212-433-WNYC. Members of the public who are consumers of journalism, certainly invited to weigh in. But I'd love to get some journalists yourselves who've thought about this. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So, David Folkenflik, as an NPR media reporter, have you considered this question of are there ever times when we should weigh the source against the value of their information and decide not to publish or broadcast?
Well, I think this issue has cropped up increasingly because there's it's so much easier to obtain information that's digitally transmitted when people are willing to hack into it. And let's pause for just a quick sec and give Eric Clifton and David Sanger and Scott Shain credit for not pulling their punches in that passage you read at the top of the hour. You know, I think that that the Times, as well as other news organizations, has had to make difficult choices, and I think people can rightly question whether the right choices were always made. Eric said that it's not right to get into gossipy stuff. Certainly at the Sony hacks, you saw a lot of exploration of one of the top executives' shopping habits on Amazon. That's not justifiable in any way, but it was sort of voyeuristic and fun for the readership of that online publication, and yet, you know, not really justifiable. On the other hand, we also learned that Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams were paid considerably less by Sony than their co-stars in a major award-winning picture than their male co-stars. Even though they were all four, seen as top line stars.
That's not gossip. That's a public issue, right?
Yeah, that was a valid exploration of gender discrimination, even at women who are among the most famous people in the world. If you think about the New York Times, this isn't the first time that New York Times has had to think about it. Think about WikiLeaks, call it 6-7 years ago, when it was deciding to try to obliterate the ability of the U.S. government and the military to, as I put it at the time, to smother the circulation of closely held secrets. You know, they were trying to expose classified information about the way in which the war was waged in Afghanistan by the U.S., and it was done despite the adamant objections of the Obama administration. The Times and The Guardian and in Germany Der Spiegel, respected publications, all essentially collaborated, although that word was something that then executive editor Bill Keller rejected. But they basically collaborated with WikiLeaks in doing that back then. They felt the information was of fundamental public interest. They felt they were careful to redact information that might harm sources and methods of U.S. intelligence and the like. But this is complicated, problematic stuff, and it's led to the present day where you don't just have a non-governmental, somewhat anarchic actor like WikiLeaks, or if you think of Edward Snowden, who saw himself as a whistleblowing contractor from the NSA, revealing incredible secrets about the way in which digital communications were monitored by the U.S. government. This is of stuff that is obtained, I'm not saying the journalistic outlets broke the law in doing this, but clearly those that obtained the information broke the law and, would be prosecuted if they could be reached by federal authorities. So these are really tough decisions. We are now in some ways at the crux of the debate, which is not there's somebody who wants to embarrass the government. There's somebody who wants to do things in conflict with the government. There's somebody who actually in some ways wants to manipulate the electoral process itself, even if, as the Times has suggested in its reporting, it's not clear that the Russians expected the candidate that they seem to be helping to actually end up in the White House. So I think these are real important issues for news organizations to be very clear about. They're going to have to make very fine gradations. I do think Hillary Clinton's speeches were newsworthy. And yet if you looked at the journalistic and chattering classes on social media, on Twitter in particular, as some of this stuff played out, even as they acknowledged some of the intellectual complications with taking this stuff from hacks, they were gleefully sort of getting into the weeds of, you know, who was sniping it, who, how much it resembled high school. And even as they were saying, don't take your eye off the ball, so much of the journalistic attention was focused to the high school-like gossip.
Yeah.
And so much was taken away from what's being done to the Democrats here, one of our two major parties.
But
this,
when you deconstructed, you know, along the lines of the content, what was gossipy and what was substantively newsworthy, that gets away from the question of the source. So would you guys agree as a principle that if the information is of public value, short of threatening someone's physical safety, let's say, because I know there are times that the Times, for example, won't publish if there's a national security threat in something that's leaked. But other than that, there's almost no time when the source would make the difference if it's true, relevant information to the public interest. Eric, is that a fair statement or a principle, or is that too simplistic?
No, I mean, I'm not prepared now to accept that as a principle because, I mean, I'm really torn about this, and I just need to think about it more, and I haven't – I mean, I just don't want to become an accomplice. But at the same time, I mean, another problem is, say, you know, some particular news organization takes a principled stand and says, we won't use it. But then, you know, there are so many other news organizations that use it. So what is the principled organization accomplishing by not using it? You know, because you've it's still in the public domain. But I don't know. I mean, I think, okay, at a minimum, In the Russian hacking situation, Guccifer 2, which was essentially a front, if we are to believe this whole, you know, plot, and as described by the intelligence services, and I'm pretty convinced that this is what really happened, if we are to believe it, Guccifer 2 is a Russian front. Guccifer 2 was offering individual reporters the opportunity to get caches of documents that he or it had not made public, and he essentially set up a Twitter direct messaging function where you could tweet message to Guccifer 2 and get, like, Florida House District race documents in particular races. And individual people, including a Republican lobbyist from Florida who had a blog, requested documents and then did damage to House candidates. I mean, that is taking it to an even different level, where you're selectively getting stuff that is not already public. And in some cases, you're getting it in password-protected places. And so, to me, in that situation, you are becoming a co-conspirator almost. I mean, you're not just – stuff hasn't been dumped into the public domain and you're debating whether or not to use it. I think that to actually be engaging with the person who has stolen the stuff and then mm-hmm. – you know, now, okay, so then you go back to Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks. I mean, so then you could say, okay, did the New York Times do that? Because, you know, the stuff was shared exclusively initially with the Times, right? Yeah. So, I mean, what am I saying here? Uh-huh. I am saying uh-huh. we shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
So, it's a very difficult – I mean, what I know is that we're in a period of transformation when it comes to this. I mean, just the amount of material that's coming forward through these venues is enormous, and it's not going to go away. But I don't know what the answer is right now. Sorry.
David, what do you want to add to that? The idea of that possible principle, the way I laid it out there, that the source really doesn't matter, shouldn't matter to a news organization if they have true, relevant information to the public interest that doesn't threaten anybody's physical safety?
I say never say never, but I think it's I'm not going to embrace a blanket policy in the way you framed it. Let me say a couple of things. First off, Eric says, you know, and I appreciate the anguish that I'm hearing as he thinks this through out loud. I respect it very much. Because the Times itself has benefited, as it did during the Pentagon Papers, from leaks. But, you know, that was a clear-cut case of a whistleblower about a specific thing about the history of the Vietnam War, of course. In this case, you know, I don't think it's fair to say, well, it's out in other places and therefore, you know, what are you going to do? This is not merely a competitive question. This is a question of, you know, what does the Times stand for? What does the Washington Post stand for? And I think even if things are available in other places, it does matter if you have to make conscious choices, and those choices actually influence others, particularly when they're made by institutions like the Times and the Post and major networks and the like, even in this age with so many other outlets. You may have to deal with the blowback from disclosures, but, you know, you don't have to necessarily engage it in fully. Excuse me. I think also, you know, you do have to in some ways consider the source and the context. If you're thinking about this Snowden issue, which certainly was controversial across the ideological spectrum in terms of what was released into public. And yet, you know, even President Obama, who thinks that Snowden should come back and face charges, has said that Snowden served a public service in making clear what was being done in the public's name, but behind very closed doors. This is different because you have essentially an asymmetrical situation. We accept in the press, all of us, all kinds of information from all kinds of actors all the time. Not all of them reside in nunneries. Not all of them are Nobel laureates or perfectly pristine people. And that's okay. We got to evaluate the information, really check it, particularly considering the source we get it from, and that's part of the game. In this case, when you have essentially somebody able to strip one party naked in public or one candidate naked in public, and it's completely asymmetrical, what happens is that by default, the sheer volume of coverage and of revelations are utterly weighed to one side rather than the other. And I know Donald Trump and his supporters will say, hey, there was a lot of critical information and coverage of Donald Trump throughout the race. And that's true, but that's because he never really received this kind of scrutiny. He's never stood for public office before, much less held it. In this case, what happened to Hillary Clinton and the Democrats was, you know, every dependent clause was stripped bare and dissected in public by major news organizations. And even if the revelations themselves, as I believe, were not that big by and large, that they were largely of a political nature rather than a truly scandalous nature, I think that it ultimately completely diverted the course of coverage and even the course of the way the campaign was able to operate.
On the other hand, there was so much criticism of Trump as unfit after the leaked videotape of him with Billy Bush on the Access Hollywood bus, right, which came out actually on the same day as the first of these Podesta emails.
Yeah,
and the Billy Bush tape was a bigger story.
That was a leak, though. That leak is different than something stolen. That was someone – I mean, when someone leaks something, you don't have the same problems as when someone steals something. This is not a crime when someone leaks something. So I don't think that the ethical debate is parallel.
You know, but let's be clear. We, you know, the press, including the New York Times, has the ability to say, rightly, you know, that case law suggests that if we receive something that we did not commission to be stolen, that we did not encourage to be stolen, but that if we receive something obtained by that person illegally, but who just hands it to us, if there's a public interest, you know, we are not breaking the law in order to publish it and or broadcast it. And, you know, I do think that the context, the newsworthiness matters. You know, even if the source is a foreign government who wants no good for the U.S., there are times where there are foreign actors who have things that cast light on how our public officials, how our military, how our, you know, other people acting in our name behave, and sometimes in problematic ways that we should probably know about. And at the same time, in this instance, I think it highlights the ability, when you have an intense effort to hack the complete inside communications of one political actor or agency or figure in an election and is willing to dole it out, you know, day by day, week by week. And as Eric and his colleagues have chronicled, apparently, you know, race by house race, essentially the press is responding quick twitch to stimuli completely outside its own control. And it's different than saying there's a story as opposed to saying there's a campaign that's being covered on this basis. If you understand what I'm saying, it's just there's a different nature that ensues, and I think it's ultimately subverting of the press being able to think independently, particularly at an age when all of its competitors, and Eric kind of alluded to this, are able to publish instantly online, and therefore you have an even greater imperative and pressure, seemingly, to try to go match it or supersede it.
David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent, and Eric Lipton, New York Times investigative reporter. As we ask the question, should news organizations refuse to publish leaked information if it comes from a foreign country trying to influence our election, or if it's stolen? Eric, go ahead.
A short point, and then we can, you know, turn the conversation a bit. But I think that the answer is that there can be no standard policy, because this is way too complicated for a standard policy. I think it has to be case by case. And the minimum standard has to be that you only use stolen material if there is a legitimate news value to it, that you only even consider using it. And then after you pass the test that it has real news value, then you decide whether or not it's too much of you becoming a tool to an interested party, and you are just executing on their plot, or the news value is great enough enough that you have no choice but to serve the public interest by writing about it. I think that, and then each case has to be evaluated on that standard. That would be my sense.
Podesta and others on the Clinton team continue to go on political TV shows, but mostly refused to comment on the content of the emails, claiming that they weren't going to spend time verifying the accuracy of something stolen by Russia and given to WikiLeaks. Here's one example. Podesta on Fox News Sunday on October 9th.
I think we should take a step back and say how we got here, which is that the Russians, as the U.S. senior members of the U.S. government confirmed, have been hacking into Democratic accounts, and now they've hacked into my account. They put out documents that are purported to be from my account. But I think if you look at what she said in this campaign to get to your question, I would just add, you know, this should be of concern to everyone that the Russians are trying to influence our election.
And really, David, we had two parallel stories from that point on. A, the Russians are trying to influence our elections, and of course, it's a story to this day. And B, oh, look what they uncovered.
That's right. I mean, look, I participated in it to the extent that I believe one of the things we learned from these emails was that Donna Brazile, while being a paid pundit for CNN, cable news network, also and vice chairwoman at that time of the Democratic Party, had been in some ways passing along information to the Clinton camp about the kinds of questions that she might receive. And there's some ambiguity about how much she
in
got
the
into the CNN
debates.
Yeah, that's right. How much she got into CNN's thinkings in the primaries, you know, that she may have been passing along things that weren't from inside CNN. But nonetheless, it showed a kind of collusion from somebody being paid by CNN theoretically to educate the public. It seemed to me that this was highlighting something I've talked about in the past, which is that it seems to me, in a sense, a corruption of journalism to have somebody who's so senior, a party official, also being paid by a news organization for her punditry. It seemed to me, who do you think she's serving there? The Democratic Party or your viewers? It, obviously, her party allegiances come first in every instance, and that helped lead to her dismissal or departure from CNN. But, you know, it also, you know, that was from those hacked things. I made sure to say these were, emails said to be hacked by the Russians and passed through WikiLeaks before being posted publicly. And at the same time, it seemed to me newsworthy, but also problematic in terms of how it came about. And in retrospect, it seemed to me sort of a very partisan thing. Yes, John Podesta. Yes, Donna Brazile. Yes, all these people say, you know, in response to any question, you know, that is something that was illegally hacked by the Russians and posted by WikiLeaks to damage Democrats. We're not going to respond to it. In retrospect, I actually have a lot more respect and a regard for that response. I understand it. I think it makes sense.
Eric, I know you got to go in a minute. Do you have time for one more question?
Okay, yes, go ahead.
Since you've looked so deeply into the hacks and their origins, let me play you two quick clips. These are like 12 seconds each, of Russia expert Stephen Cohen, Princeton professor emeritus, on this show yesterday. He's generally seen as a defender of Putin. Here's one.
Now we have this hacking story for which there are, as yet, no public facts. And what's happened is the whole discourse about Russia in Washington has turned into a kind of hysteria.
And?
The question of what facts we have for hacking, we will not know until they're actually presented. So far, including in this endlessly long, it must be 15,000 words in the Times today, no actual facts are presented.
So that was your article he was referring to, Eric.
Okay, let me start off by saying it was 7,200 words, so he's got his facts wrong. So maybe you should check his facts before he speaks on the radio. And secondly, I mean, you know, we spoke to a lot of cyber security experts, and there is agreement across the board in the intelligence community, and there's agreement among every publicly spoken member of Congress, with the exception, you know, in the government, with the exception of Donald Trump, that there were Russian actors involved in this hack. So the malware that they used has specific attributes that have previously been identified and attributed to Russian actors, and you know, again, so I think that the question as to whether or not they were trying to influence the specific outcome of the election is open to debate. I think that's a valid debate. Did they necessarily want, you know, Donald Trump to win over Hillary Clinton? I don't think that's conclusively decided. But whether or not there were Russian actors involved in this, from everything I've been told from people that, you know, that I at this point trust, it's conclusive. So I do think that there's a need for an independent investigation. I don't think there should be an investigation by a House or Senate committee. There should be an independent commission appointed that has subpoena power power, that has an executive oversight, you know, by someone that's appointed who has, you know, that the public has trust in. Because if you leave it in the hands of a partisan committee, you know, then it will not be a truly independent investigation. I think that the only way, I think this is important enough, and the threat to American democracy, not only in this election, but potentially in future elections, is significant enough that there needs to be a very thorough and public vetting of what exactly happened here, which actors were involved, and what the appropriate response is. And the only way that will be done is through an independent commission.
Eric, thanks for your reporting, and thanks so much for being willing to come on and talk about it today.
Thank you.
Eric Lipton, New York Times investigative reporter. David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us. WNYC. Happy New Year, everyone. We continue this morning with one of the essayists in WNYC's Dear President series that the station commissioned this fall. Robert Jones, a Brooklyn writer whose essay was called One Black Body, which is largely about notions of black masculinity. Robert, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And your essay, for people who haven't heard it, was about your grandfather, who for a long time rejected you, didn't even talk to you because you're gay, but he came to evolve. And you wrote that for black men like your grandfather, being gay equaled failure at manhood. Can you talk about his idea of manhood in the context of his life?
Certainly. My grandfather was exposed very early on to concepts of black masculinity associated with the Nation of Islam, and that set has a very stringent view of what it means to be a black man. One of the unspoken truths about black men in the black community in America is that many of us walk around feeling as though we're failed white men. And we see ourselves that way because we see white men have power and resources and material items, all of these things that we covet. And we think if we follow a stringent example of manhood as set forth by white men, then perhaps we'll reach some sort of level of power as well.
And so you think black men develop certain notions of masculinity partly because they feel emasculated within a white society.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct.
What effects do you think that societal emasculation has on one's notion of masculinity?
It certainly makes black men believe that, the way to achieve my manhood then is through some sort of force or violence. I have to grab it back because that way I can protect my friends, myself, my family, and I need women and queer people and maybe even disabled people to be subordinate so that I can basically be at the top of some hierarchy.
Listeners, we invite your phone calls for Robert Jones. Black men and black women want to react to his ideas about black masculinity and his story about him and his grandfather. Non-black listeners, you too, maybe in the context of a series called Dear President, Masculinity in America, as Donald Trump's version replaces Barack Obama's in the White House. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Your grandfather died in 2014 at the age of 96, you tell us, but he came to reconcile with you and maybe to recognize, you speculate, that his vision of black masculinity was just as limiting as white supremacy.
Absolutely. One of the wonderful things about my grandfather in his final years was that he grew to understand that his love for me was more powerful than any indoctrination he received, any misconceptions he had about what it meant to be a man. He was able to respect that there was a spectrum of manhood, not just this one very narrow thing that he had been told was what it meant to be a man, specifically a black man.
The essay series is called Dear President, and of course, Donald Trump rode old notions of masculinity to his election win. Is there something you want the president-elect to hear in the story of you and your grandfather?
Yes. Donald Trump, for me, embodies that toxic aspect of masculinity that can only realize itself as when it's putting someone down, when it's stepping on someone else's throat. His comments about women are abhorrent. They're just absolutely horrible. And one of the great disappointments for me was the number of people who voted for him, irrespective of those particular comments. They were very pointed and pointed to a very one of the things we don't talk about, which is the rape culture in this country. So what I would like Trump to recognize is to please display something healthier for not just for other men, but so that the entire country can understand that this is not how we treat others. We embrace others. We don't step on them.
The notions of masculinity that Trump appealed to are often seen as predominantly white working class. Do you think there might be some parallel experiences, or maybe just very different ones that you would want to mention, that drive a lot of guys from that demographic into, you know, cis male and straight male patriarchy, even as your grandfather's experience of being black and poor and arrested and then bolstered by the Nation of Islam affected him?
I think there are quite a number of similarities, actually. This concept of masculinity as we understand it in America relies on power, and any man, irrespective of their race, even irrespective of their sexuality, if they feel powerless, they feel violence is the way to get that power back, aggression, that we have to succumb to their power, that they have to be coercive through force. And I wish I knew the answer to how to teach them to find healthier ways to empower themselves.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Taher in Westchester. Taher, you're on WNYC. Hi.
How you doing, Brian?
Good. Thanks for calling.
In regards to what he was saying in regards about the Nation of Islam, as being a straight black man who does follow some of the teachings of the Nation of Islam, I definitely get what he's saying when he says that it's a very masculine-based culture. But what I will say is the reason why homosexuality in general is, I guess, kind of looked down in the black community is because back in the day during, you know, slavery times and so on and so forth, it was like breaking them in and making the black men look weak in regards to stuff like that. So a lot of black people hold a lot of, like, strength and disdain towards homosexuality because it's a way to look strong. It's a way to put yourself as the hierarchy when we never had that power beforehand.
I think that's exactly what you're saying, Robert, right?
Indeed. And additionally, there is a segment of the black population that believes that prior to European invasion, there was no such thing as homosexuality in Africa. That is provably false. But what that does is it helps people who feel powerless to feel that there's another group they can subjugate. And in addition, it gives black, straight black men and maybe even straight black women the power to say, I can win if there's someone beneath me. It's very sad.
Jay in Westbury, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Like I say, man, it's preach. But I wanted to ask you, you answered some of my questions that I initially wanted to ask. How does that translate specifically into the Donald Trump failed white men concept? And how basically I want you to revisit that whole concept. How does that translate into white men feeling powerless in the society that we live in? And as well, I would like you to address how can we reverse it and in the black community and allow black men to understand that education is the key to them feeling power, understanding where it is that they live, and understanding that once you understand where it is that you live, that's how you obtain power.
Great questions. To begin, I think the idea of wealth is tied very strongly to manhood in this country, and people who don't have access to that feel particularly if they're men, feel less than men. And so that powers a lot of poor people across demographics to try to achieve that through violence and aggression and other means. To your second question about how do we push this conversation forward, that's a very great question. And I think, as you said, education is key. The key is to get many men in particular to stop thinking of education as a feminine endeavor. Not that there's anything wrong with femininity at all, but the idea that it is you're born from a man and a woman. Both of those things reside within you. There's a yin and a yang and everything in between. So there's no reason to try to push the feminine away or to run away from the feminine. It is what makes you whole. And that's what we have to start.
How have you seen President Obama as a role model for men, black men in particular, and also men in general?
I like his intellect. I think that he held his role with a certain amount of grace, that he didn't often succumb to the idea that in order to be strong, you also had to be mean or aggressive or unkind. So for that, I appreciate the president.
He's gotten some criticism for being too preachy in telling black men to be responsible fathers, for example, without enough focus on the context of racism and the cultural dynamics that set them up. Have you thought about that question?
I have been one of his staunchest critics on that. What Obama was doing, in my opinion, was performing for white people. Often when he spoke to primarily black audiences, I almost felt like he wasn't speaking to them, but he was speaking to the white people standing behind them. These things about pull up your pants and these really superficial looks at the dynamics of race in this country and telling black people that they can't use white supremacy as an excuse. Now, I don't know any black people that use that as an excuse, but white supremacy is a material reality. It's a material obstacle. And I had hoped that the president at some point would have been able to address that directly.
I see you also reviewed the new movie Moonlight in Essence last month, and you praised it as a film that re-envisions manhood as a space where vulnerability and imagination are acceptable. Want to talk about Moonlight a little and some of that idea of, you know, masculinity that you're celebrating there?
What I loved about that film was not only how much it mirrored my own coming of age, but how it was so nuanced in its approach to masculinity that this black man who was ostensibly at some point feminine had to become masculine out of necessity to protect himself. So the movie's critique is we destroy these men by forcing them to fit into this box that we think is healthy, and it is ultimately unhealthy, and the movie displayed that with such wit.
So then what's the difference? Is there a meaningful difference worth preserving between masculinity and femininity in their enlightened forms?
You know, I struggle to try to determine what does it mean to be masculine in a healthy way. I've only seen masculinity in in unhealthy ways, warlike, militaristic behavior. Anything else, to me, I'm like, what's the difference between that and femininity? Strong people can be masculine and feminine.
Let's try Valerie in Soho. Valerie, if you're there, we've got about 20 seconds for you now. Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to know if the writer is familiar with Eldridge Cleaver's book, Soul on Ice, in which he described the four categories of men and women, black women, white women, black men, and white men. And all through the election, I kept thinking that Donald Trump was going towards what Eldridge Cleaver described in 1968 as the role of white men that they were desperately trying to hold on to. I wonder if you could comment on that.
I am familiar with that work. He was a very popular figure with a lot of people and still is. He was actually very critical of someone that I hold very dear, James Baldwin. So those ideas of toxic masculinity simply do not work.
The Son of Baldwin, your Twitter handle?
Yes, it is.
Where can people see other of your work?
You could see it on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram.
Robert Jones, thank you very much for making us think today.
Thank you.
And you can read his essay and the others in the Dear President series on our website. More to come. Stay tuned. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Happy New Year again, everyone. If your New Year's resolution is to look for a new job, I'm sure you hope to find one where you'll have a decent boss, someone who'll answer your questions, someone who won't take credit for your work, someone who'll occasionally ask how you're doing. That would be nice. But my next guest isn't satisfied with a decent boss. He went looking for a breed beyond. Dartmouth Business School professor Sidney Finkelstein decided to study what he calls super bosses. In his book by that name, Finkelstein examines the leaders who sit at the top of coaching trees, who inspire their employees to accomplish more than they ever thought possible, even if it means letting them go. Sidney Finkelstein, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hi there. Great to be on with you, Brian.
So you say if you study the top 50 leaders in any field, as many as one-third will have worked for a super boss. So what's the difference between a really great boss and a super boss?
So a super boss has this incredible track record of spawning a generation of talent. You look at someone like Norman Brinker, you know, the guy that invented the Chili's restaurant chain and Brinker's and Steak and Ale. So many of the people that are running fast casual restaurant chains today, from P.F. Chang to Lone Star, many of those senior executives, they all cut their teeth working with Brinker. This is the pattern you see time and time again in industry after industry. These people help other people get better and create opportunities for them they wouldn't otherwise get.
I'm going to go down your list of types of super bosses, and one is glorious bastards, which you say is a type of super boss that cares about one thing, winning. Let's see, who am I thinking of like that that's in the news? Is Donald Trump a glorious bastard by the definition of your book?
Actually, I don't think so. Glorious Bastard has a very positive side to go with that dominance of winning, and that is they understand that to win you need the world's best teams, the best talent, and you have to make room for that type of talent. And while I haven't worked for Donald Trump, and we only know what we know from watching him pretty much every day, there doesn't seem to be a ton of evidence that he's making a lot of room for others, that he's helping other people get better. It's all about him. And that's not what a glorious bastard does. Working for somebody like that has to open up doors and create opportunities. That's what glorious bastards do. It's not obvious that that's the case with Trump.
But you mean a super boss can still be somebody who cares about one thing, and that's winning?
So it's one of the three types of super bosses. You know, somebody like Larry Ellison, the founder, longtime CEO at Oracle, really a tough guy, not easy to work for. But if you can handle it, if you can kind of run the gamut and make it through, the opportunities that he creates are fantastic. In fact, one of the people I interviewed that used to work for Ellison said, you know, the one thing Larry's really good at is creating opportunities. He produces opportunities. That's why these people can have, you know, lots of upside for you.
Listeners, do you think you've ever worked for a super boss? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or what do you think your less than super bosses could learn from super bosses? 212-433-9692 for Sidney Finkelstein, who wrote this new book. All right, the other two types of super bosses that you list are nurturers and iconoclasts. Tell us about nurturers.
So nurturers are maybe the ones that come closest to the mentors that many people may have had or thought about. I actually think of them as mentors on steroids. They do a lot of the things that mentors do, which is they'll support you, they'll provide some advice, but they will go even further than that, and they'll be constantly providing you with, they'll be teachers, really. They'll be rolling up their sleeves and working with you in kind of an apprenticeship type of approach, which, by the way, is how everyone learned how to do everything for centuries, and it's only in the last, you know, 100 years or so that the apprenticeship model has gone by the side. Super bosses have brought it back. And then the other type, of course, are the iconoclasts, the creative types. Miles Davis is my favorite example, not the type of person most people think about would be in a book about business and bosses and leadership, but someone who, you look at the people in his band, you know, really world-class superstars of today, Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter and Bill Evans, John Coltrane. He discovered some or most of those people. He helped them get better. He opened doors for them, and then they ended up becoming these legends in their own right.
Let's see. Some other individuals who you single out in the book who people may have heard of. Jack Welch at General Electric, also Ralph Lauren. Tell me about Ralph Lauren.
Yeah, so Ralph, you know, you look at Ralph and you look at the world of American fashion, who has had a bigger influence, and not just in kind of design or arts or success, but in talent. So many people that are successful today got their start, really, or spent a little bit of time with Ralph Lauren. People like Vera Wang and Tory Burch and Joseph Aboud. And there's a long, long list. What did he do that was so special? It was really fascinating. He inspired people to believe that they could do anything. You know, everyone works in a 24/7 world these days. We're all working hard, and the pressure is on. You got to produce. But what Superboss is doing, Ralph was a great example, is he instills a sense of confidence into his people so that they really believe that they can do anything. And one of the things Ralph used to say, especially in the earlier days when he was obviously a much smaller company, he says, "We set the standard. Everybody follows us. We're the ones. People are going to copy what we do." And he so fired up people. And, of course, you know, you got to be authentic with a thing like that. You can't pretend. You got to really believe it. And that inspiration, that vision that he had, and his ability to convey that and energize people with that was a big part of what helped other people get better and successful working for him.
Elizabeth in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Oh, hi there. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I want to speak about a female super boss that I worked for in the 60s.
Yay.
And she was in the 70s as well. Her name was Ursula Nordstrom. You may have heard of her. She was the director of children's books at Harper & Row Publishers. And she had an interesting way of training everybody in the office. There was something called the files that you were required to read. Every piece of correspondence that went through the office, in or out, was in the files, including editorial letters to authors, contracts, everything. So that you learned about the running of the publishing business by working in her office. And in addition, possibly in order to protect herself from any kind of threat from within the department, she trained her editors so well and inspired them so that many of them went off to head up children's departments at other major companies or to start their own children's book companies.
Great example. Are you familiar with Ursula Nordstrom?
I'm not, and I'm sorry that I'm not, because that would have definitely made the book. It sounds like a perfect example. It's somebody that teaches. You know, you work for you work for a leader like that, and she opens doors. She teaches you. She wants you to get better. Who wouldn't want a boss like that? So thank you for sharing that one, Elizabeth.
Another woman in your book, you give the example of Mary Kay Ash.
Yeah, Mary Kay Ash, and of course that was kind of a legendary company of creating opportunities for women. But you know, Brian, my favorite example of a female super boss is Alice Waters. You know, from Chef Panisse and the great restaurant in Berkeley.
Yeah.
The person that really created in America farm-to-table local sourcing of high-quality ingredients, organic food, which of course is how every restaurant operates today. And there's so many people that worked for Alice, worked in the restaurant, that have gone on to tremendous. I mean, it's in the hundreds of people. And I'll tell you a little anecdote. April Bloomfield, who is the chef at the Breslin in New York, and a couple of other places. She was an established chef in the UK when she came to the U.S. to open up her first restaurants. And as soon as she got to the U.S., she said, "The first thing I need to do is go spend some time with Alice to see how America cooks and thinks about food." I mean, imagine an impact like that you can have. And that's what Alice was and is.
Dave in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What's your question?
Oh, I haven't worked for a super boss, but I've worked for a lot of bosses who try to imitate super bosses that they read about in books like yours, or self-authored books like, Jack Welch's. And a lot of them tend to not do very well. They act like they're checking boxes in applying these techniques. And so I'm wondering, how does somebody learn to become a super boss other than working for one? Or is it one of those things where some managers are just kind of born with it and figure it out for themselves and others don't?
It's a great question. Thank you. I really believe, after spending 10 years working on this and talking to so many people, I really believe that anyone can become a super boss. You have to really want to do it. You can't just, as you say, it's not just about checking the boxes. You have to invest in it. You don't become Ralph Lauren by just checking a couple of boxes and you're done. You have to really care about it, dedicate yourself, and there are a lot of things you can do to get started. I'll give you an example. Anyone who's a boss, who's a leader, has people in their team, in their group that work for them. Well, how do you motivate them? How do you energize them? How do you supervise them? Are you customizing how you do that? What works for, Mary is not necessarily going to work for Anne. You've got to do something different for each person. You need to spend the time to understand those people. That type of customization, that's not, again, a rocket science thing. Anyone could do that. You have to invest the time. You got to be willing to do it. And it's one of dozens and dozens of things that super bosses do. So maybe I'm an optimist, but I think anyone could become a super boss.
Sydney Finkelstein, author of Super Bosses, How Exceptional Leaders Master the Flow of Talent. He's a business professor at Dartmouth. Stay warm in Hanover.
Thank you, Brian. Great talking to you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Time for the latest news, live from the WNYC newsroom. Happy New Year, everyone. The Brian Lehrer Show is on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer, WNYC. A first-time caller and a long-time listener asks me how I am. That was a haiku. I'm Brian Lehrer. Poetry is in our everyday life. That's what my next guest says in his new book, The Poetry of Everyday Life, Storytelling and the Art of Awareness. Steve Zeitlin is the executive director of City Lore, and his new book shares his experience searching for the often overlooked artistic moments that comprise our day-to-day lives. He's joined here by Sahar Marathi, the Afghan-American poet who curated the Poetic Voices of the Muslim World exhibit at City Lore. Steve, welcome back. Sahar, welcome to WNYC. And Steve, what exactly does it mean to find poetry in everyday life? Or is the answer just obvious?
No, of course. You have to have a philosophical bent to see the world that way. I oftentimes think we write to order the mess. And our lives are a kind of laundry list of events and happenings. And the way in which we make sense of them is to either put them in poetic form in some way to express ourselves in painting or in poetry or in prose, or if not, to see the poetry in things, to see the poetry in motion or the poetry in basketball, or it's in seeing the poetry in chess or in any of the different aspects of life that we kind of elevate life and find meaning in it.
So you use poetry as a stand-in for any kind of art, I guess, right? You could have said finding the folklore in everyday art, the stories in everyday art.
That's right. And it's because I'm a word person that I called it the poetry of everyday life. And we think of human beings as homo poeticus, there are many other things, but I tend to find the meanings in life through words.
And you write, and Sahar will get to you in a minute, but you write, listening deeply is key to tuning into the poetry of everyday life. And you give examples of people you talk to for your job as a folklorist, and that they taught you something about language and how to use language to understand the world, like from the documentarian Kawule Kamara, you learned about how an ancient mythology can shape a way of life far from its indigenous roots.
That's right. And Kaoli will also say, if I just say that, you're Brian Lehrer or he's Keoli Kamara, that would be one thing. But if you say that he's his parents are Maury Kamara and Sahadi Kamara, and he comes from the mouth of the Niger River, then you're elevating them. And there's something in that kind of African poetry that's wonderful and sort of teaches us that we all elevate ourselves by putting a poetic spin on our world.
Sahar, you curated the Poetic Voices of the Muslim World. Can you tell us about that project?
Yes. Well, I should say that I curated it along with our partners at Poets House, and my predecessor, Catherine Fletcher, was the real vision behind this this exhibit. The exhibit explores an art form that's central to the lives of Muslims around the world, and that is poetry. Specifically, we highlight poetic traditions in Arabic, Urdu, Turkish, and Farsi. And we also feature poetries from Asia, Africa, and diaspora communities here in the U.S. And alongside the poetic traditions, we have artwork by the acclaimed Pakistani artist Samina Qureshi, who draws a lot of inspiration from, among other arts, Sufi poetry. And I think might be of great interest to your listeners, we also have some New York City artists in the form of students whose teachers participated in our Summer Institute on Understanding Arts of the Muslim World.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. I see that your family had a particular relationship to poetry, that you made a habit of consulting the 14th century poet Hafez during your childhood. Can you talk about that?
That tradition still continues? Yes, and it's a tradition across Central and West Asia. Hafiz is, alongside the Quran, his collected works, I think, are in many homes across the region. And I actually brought a copy here. So what I would do is, if I had a problem or if my mother, any member of our family, had an issue we wanted to resolve, we would consult his divan, his collection, and we would make an invocation in Farsi and then at random open a page.
And you're holding it right there.
I'm holding it, yes. It's actually a holy book to me. So, for example, I would hold the question in my heart. I might ask, like, will I pass this exam on Friday? Or something larger, you know, like what will my life...
Yeah, that one's pretty mundane, really.
Okay, we can get deeper.
No, it's okay, but yeah. Poetry can even give you spiritual guidance in that realm.
Absolutely. It can guide you, can give you comfort, it can inspire you. And Hafiz.
Is there a verse you want to read?
Sure, of Hafiz or any verse?
Well, I was thinking of Hafiz.
Well, how about you give me how about I at random open to a page based on a question that you have, and then I'll interpret for you what Hafiz says?
Let's see. Steve, help me out here. Throw a question.
Will the exhibit be a success?
So I'll do my invocation. Ya Hafiz Shiraz, tu ra bar shakh nabat qasam mitum agar rast bar ma bugui bare azi. So I just invoked him, please give me the truth about this question. And here's the interpretation according to Abbas Aryanpour Kashani's translation.
Because you just opened to a page at random?
At random.
Okay.
So then there's a poem, and then there's an interpretation beneath it. And the poem begins, those who by a glance turn the dust to gold should care for Hafiz through forsaken and old. Better hide from rival physicians my pain. Perhaps from divine treasure, cure I gain. And very quickly, the interpretation says, though you are of some age and do not expect great things to happen, yet there will come to you a great blessing. So there we have it.
Interesting. I took the first line of that to mean, because of course I'm a great Hafiz interpreter, took the first line of that to mean, don't be attached so much to whether the opening is a success tomorrow. But anyway,
that's another interpretation.
There was. If you want to read that first line again, you could blow me out of the water and reveal my inability to interpret it. Steve, you give advice in the book to those who are trying to shepherd the poetry in themselves, in their everyday lives, to the outside world. And one piece of advice is to write an I am from poem. What is that?
Well, it's a common writing assignment in some ways, but it just so profound in the variety of responses that you get. And really, I feel like that poem, which is really people, you know, realizing that, you know, God is in the details and so are they. By giving the details of where you're from, you really get a sense of who you are personally and culturally. So it's really a combination of what I try to do in the book, which is combine folklore and creative writing into one thing. But because folklore is oftentimes the things passed down in families over generations, and your poetry is something coming right out of an individual. And I've tried to combine those two in this book, you know, which is in the poetry of everyday life.
Now, we've only got 5 minutes left in the segment, but let's see if anybody out there, maybe we'll just get one on, wants to try an attempt at an I am from poem. One line, okay, because we need to keep these short. Call in and give us one line, not like I am from Bed-Stuy or the Lower East Side. Make it a little more descriptive, like one of them in Steve's book that comes from – these come from students in the book. I am from controlling the flow of fire hydrant water through a can of Chef Boyardee while dreaming of swimming in a real pool one day. Or another one is I am from waiting for Mr. Softee's beautiful symphony. Or I am from a bar or bat mitzvah every weekend – and that awful naked feeling of chilly pantyhose at 13 in expert makeup braces for years and years before I was pretty. You get the idea. So who can write one like this in the next 3 minutes and call in with it? 212-433-WNYC. Start with I am from and fill in the blank. 212-433-9692 if you dare to engage in some speed poetry writing.
Or a student at Yeshiva Flatbush High School. I am from technology, the microprocessor as a way of life. Or Stacy Morrison's Fragile Spirit. She was a student of mine. I am from porcelain figures, too close to the edge of the table.
Bob in Rego Park is going to give it a shot. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Brian. How you doing, buddy? My statement is this. I am from the land of the immortals. When I leave my body, I shall return to my sacred home.
Thank you very much.
I give it a snap, snap.
Diane in Harlem, you're ready too?
I am. This is on the fly, but I am from teenage parents who had a dream and values for a little girl growing up in Philadelphia. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. That was cool. How about Sherry in the Bronx? Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Ready? Okay. I am from parents and their parents and their parents upon whose shoulders I stand.
Beautiful. And one more. Ashley on Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Hi.
I am from chaos running to seek security.
All right. So you know, Brian, so many people have come up with these great things.
In like 30 seconds.
And of course, I can't put them in the book because the book is done, but I'm going to start a blog called The Poetry of Everyday Life. So please send Steve at citylore.org your I Am From poems because I'm continuing to work on this idea that the book is based on called The Poetry of Everyday Life.
Sahara, I think Kafka maybe said that a poet or a novelist is like a pickaxe that attacks the way we've got things arranged. Mm-hmm. So it's a form of rebellion in and of itself.
Absolutely. It's a way of seeing that's different, that's seeing through. And I think the exhibit highlights all the ways in which poetry is a powerful way of seeing and undoing untruths. And I just to bring it back to Steve's book, we do highlight the oral traditions and the everydayness of poetry across Muslim cultures, whether they're on painted trucks in Pakistan or in wedding traditions in Yemen, or they are used on Tahrir Square during the Arab Spring and other resistance movements. So just the power of poetry in everyday life.
In everyday life. And that's the title of Steve Zeitlin's new book, The Poetry of Everyday Life, Storytelling and the Art of Awareness. And Sahar Moradi has been with us, the Afghan-American poet who is curating Poetic Voices of the Muslim World
at City Lore Gallery at 56 East 1st Street in the Lower East Side.
And you have another 15 seconds to tell people the kinds of things they'll see there.
Well, may I close with a short poem?
Please.
This is from Nima Yushij, the Iranian poet. It's time for the end of days to cry out and stain blue this page and this dynasty. Time for the flood that crushed our houses to rise up and reach for the top, to rip out this fragile footing and wash the wrongs from this land.
Can you top this? No way. So we end it here. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us. WNYC, and there's plenty to worry about in the new year, but maybe because of that, hashtag self-care, a good New Year's resolution might be to get out more this winter to some of the city's great cultural offerings as we start 2017. Here are some items worth getting out and braving the cold to fill your cultural calendars for January, February, and March, from theater and art to comedy and music. Let's go. It was Pablo Picasso who said, "Art is the lie that enables us to realize the truth." In a political era where it's almost impossible to tell fact from fiction, we could use all the help we can get in discerning what's real. Here to tell us some of what not to miss is WNYC's art critic, Deborah Solomon. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for that fabulous introduction. And also thank you, I want to quickly say, for your really brilliant election coverage and your coverage of its heartbreaking aftermath, heartbreaking for some of us. And you, I think you're really a great voice of reason in an age of deep unreason.
You're very kind. So let's talk about art. Mm-hmm. And Russia is hot in the news. I'll make the segue this way. Russia obviously hot in the news, mm-hmm. but a show that's all about Russia is on view at MoMA through early March. It's called The Revolutionary Impulse, The Rise of the Russian Avant-Garde. And you said before you came on that this exhibit belongs in a category called Shows to Recharge Your Brain Cells. How so?
The timing is perfect because Russia is very much on our minds these days, and it's too bad we can't just go back to constructivism and suprematism and the era of Malevich. The Russian avant-garde flourished in 1917. We're just about to celebrate the centennial of the Russian Revolution. And there was a brief period, brief, let's say 20 years, not that brief, I guess, when artists believed that they could really reform society, that all people could benefit from art, that it wasn't just for noblemen to put in castles or for oligarchs to put in their houses, that every person could benefit from looking at paintings, and that kind of utopian belief in art, that belief in art's centrality, has really never existed since. It went out of favor, of course, when Stalin came into power and art in Russia became propaganda. But to see this show is to really feel nostalgia, I think, for an era when people did believe in the social powers of art, and also to feel sadness about a future that never arrived.
So that's at MoMA.
And I just want
uptown.
To say one more thing about the show. What I love about it, I have to say this, that it has a lot of women artists in it, including
Russian avant-garde women artists.
Right. All the Ovas. Their names all end in Ova. You know this. Rosanova, Lydia Popova, Natalia Goncharova. And it's, you know, it's a real triumph of Ovas. It's great to see women such a large part in a show.
Great. Let's go through some more quickly because, unfortunately, our time is short. Moving uptown to another show that you say is not to be missed, one that a lot of people have been talking about is the Kerry James Marshall Show at the Met Broyer. What should we know about why that's making such a splash?
Kerry James Marshall, if you haven't seen it, please go see it. It's to me an incredible triumph because Kerry James Marshall is a black artist. He's 61. He lives in Chicago. And he first emerged in the 90s at a time when identity art was becoming popular. And people thought of identity art at that time as an excuse for banality and whining and special grievances. And they felt like it somehow tainted the higher point of art. You look at the show, These paintings are so gorgeous and so humorous and so virtuosic, and you realize that really the best art, I think the best art of the past generation, has come from artists who were kept down and who are exploring themes of identity in their work.
The Brooklyn Museum, on a similar note, has planned a series of shows under the rubric of A Year of Yes, Reimagining Feminism.
Mm-hmm.
What is the yes reference?
Well, yes is good in any context, isn't it? I'm all for yes. Better than a year of no. I think Marilyn Minter, the painter who's there now, is a must-see artist who came of age at the beginning of the feminist movement in the 1970s and has a lot to say. And I think that those who believe we're in a post-feminist era, are totally deceived. And since the election and the defeat of Hillary, we're reminded that we all have to work harder for equality. It's a work in progress. It's not a finished work. And I congratulate the Brooklyn Museum for doing a year of shows devoted to the history of feminism.
And then if you're looking to get down and dirty, there's the Queens Museum show dedicated to the, Merle Laterman Euclides?
Merle Euclides.
Uh-huh.
And she's a genius. I mean, she has a show at the Queens Museum about the art of maintenance. She decided early in her career that that she was going to photograph herself in the act of cleaning, in the act of being a housewife, and exhibit the photographs as art. And in some sense, she belonged to the Duchampian tradition. Duchamp famously said at the beginning of the 20th century, art is what an artist says it is. What is art? It's anything an artist says is art, right? So she has decided that photographs of herself cleaning the floor are art, and they are. And they also make you aware that cleaning is really an act of incredible tenderness. Makes me think of the monkeys in the zoo. Did you ever watch where primates picking, the mothers picking the fur of their babies?
Yeah.
Pulling off all those dead cells, skins.
I've had that experience, cleaning up some of my own kids' stuff, even if they should have been doing it.
Right. So see it as an act of tenderness. Don't get angry about it.
Looking ahead to something that's not quite open yet, January 10th, mm-hmm. You're excited, I see, about a show called Inventing Downtown, Artist-Run Galleries in New York City, 1952 to 65, at the Gray Art Gallery at NYU.
I can't wait. It's the first, I think, really important show of 2017. I say that without having seen it, of course. I might be wrong. But it explores the whole era of artist-run galleries. And it's a very romantic period when artists supported one another before we had these big mega galleries. And it's a scene that has largely been lost to history in some ways because artists didn't write the histories of those galleries. So I think it will offer us a view of a hidden New York that will be very moving.
Another show opening at the Met Broyer is Marsden Hartley's Maine. Now, this was a guy who was friends with some European heavyweights like Kandinsky, Franz Marc, an expat Gertrude Stein. But these paintings depict America, Maine to be exact.
I know. Marsden Hartley is one of my favorite painters. And he was an American, of course, from the early part of the 20th century. I am really looking forward to the show. It's nice that it's at the Met instead of the Whitney Museum of American Art, because I think it gives him a largeness, an international largeness that he deserves.
And I guess we can't not mention the Whitney Biennial, which opens March 17th.
It's the first biennial in the Whitney's new building. So the question is, can the building, which everyone loves, save the biennial, which is famous for being hated by everyone? So that will be an interesting collision to look forward to in March.
Do you know any particulars?
No, I try not to.
And there's going to be a big Rauschenberg retrospective, Robert Rauschenberg, at MoMA.
I'm very excited about that. It opens in May. It's a ways off, but I think that assemblage is one of the great traditions in American art. It started in Europe with Schwitters, who picked up bus tickets off the floor, made collages, but it really reached its apogee in New York because we understand trash.
We started with a Picasso quote, so we'll end with a Rauschenberg quote. Said he wanted to work, quote, in the gap between art and life. suggesting he questioned the distinction between art objects and everyday objects, reminiscent of the issues raised by The Fountain, by Dada pioneer Marcel Duchamp. But in a world where it's hard to distinguish between reality television and reality, are statements like this a foregone conclusion now?
No. I think that, you know, we turn to art, especially now, to escape the moment. Art, to me, is about getting away from the headlines, which are such an assault on our values and also on our nervous systems. I think many of us really feel emotionally ragged these days. And when I read, and right now I'm reading in the Existentialist Cafe, or when I go to an art show, it provides, I feel physically relieved to be leaving this moment and moving to another moment and being reminded that there are other worlds and other values.
And we have to leave it there with that high-minded thought from WNYC art critic Deborah Solomon. By the way, folks, we have some paintings on our website from some of the upcoming exhibits that she's talked about, some visuals. You can check them out at WNYC.org. Deborah, always a pleasure. Thanks for the previews.
Thank you, Brian.
Now some more winter previews. Let's hear about plays, musicals, and festivals from Time Out New York's theater editor, David Cody. Hey, David, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
And let's start on Broadway. There's more to life than Hamilton. And one musical that's recently opened and is getting a lot of buzz is Dear Evan Hansen. That's an odd name for a show, but I gather it's doing well at the box office.
It is. It's got great word of mouth and deservedly so. It's a new musical about a very socially awkward teenager in high school who feels like quite an outsider, and through a very interesting turn of events in the school, he suddenly becomes very popular due to his connection to a teen suicide. So it's kind of a dark story about social media and peer pressure and the social dynamics of high school. And it's just it's a very emotionally affecting piece with a beautiful new score by Benj Pasek and Justin Paul.
How about new musicals coming up? One I see sounds unusual, Come From Away, based on the true story of travelers stranded in Newfoundland on 9/11.
Yeah, that's basically the premise. It's a whole bunch of strangers whose planes had to make emergency landings out of security concern on 9/11. And I suppose it's a story of strangers getting to know each other. So you have a lot of different people from different backgrounds, the humor, the tension, the drama of that.
Gilligan's Island meets South Pacific?
I don't know if that's the pitch line, but yeah. There's a lot of musicals this spring and this winter and spring that are kind of based on well-known, based on well-known works such as, Groundhog Day.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Amelie,
that's right. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, this new musical based on very well-known material. Anastasia, musical based on the animated film from a few years back. It'll be interesting to see how the races shape up in terms of Tony time. An original musical like Dear Evan Hansen versus these shows that have very sort of trademark names to them.
Groundhog Day the musical.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to play the same song over and over again?
Yeah, it'll be a minimalist style. I haven't seen that. It did the sort of out-of-town tryouts, very far out-of-town in London, and got some good reviews. The music and lyrics by Tim Minchin, who did Matilda, which also had some success on Broadway. So we'll see how it goes. There's actually, Roald Dahl apparently is big in the musical world now because now, of course, we're having Charlie and the Chocolate Factory later this year.
And then I see Sunset Boulevard with Glenn Close and Miss Saigon both return.
Yeah, revivals are never scarce on Broadway. Glenn Close is returning to the role that she originated. And, I suppose she hasn't lost her aptitude for playing, deluded and deluded and secluded. And as far as Miss Saigon goes, we'll see how that does. I mean, that was, of course, people think of it as an 80s musical, though it really opened, I think, in 1990. But it's one of the big sort of behemoths of that period of musicals coming over from France or England that sort of dominated the landscape 20 years ago or so.
There's always a parade of movie stars who try their hand on Broadway and plays. I see some luminaries of the screen are coming to the stage this winter.
Yeah, Cate Blanchett is going to be appearing in a limited run of a show called The Present, which is an adaptation of Platonov, which is a very obscure early play by Anton Chekhov. But this play has been sort of completely re-envisioned. It's now set not in the 1890s or 1880s, but it's set in post-perestroika Russia. And it's sort of a comedy drama about old lovers and friends. So, yes, she's going to be one of the bigger names. Sally Field is coming back to Broadway in a revival of The Glass Menagerie. That should be rather exciting.
Tennessee Williams, The Glass Menagerie.
Mm-hmm.
There have been several fairly recent revivals of Glass Menagerie. Why is it so persistent?
Well, I mean, it's a great play. I mean, that's one thing. It also has a very plum role for slightly older actresses in Amanda Wingfield, the matriarch of the family. I don't know. I guess it's sort of like King Lear. Whenever an actor gets to be of a certain age, they decide that it's time for them to give their King Lear. So Amanda Wingfield is somewhere in that same category. And it's interesting. Joe Mantello is playing Tom, her son, in the piece. And in the reality of the play, Joe Mantello might be, you know, a little older for that role, but it's not a strictly realistic play. It's a memory play, and there's some wiggle room for interpretation.
And another revival of sorts, August Wilson's play, Jitney, mm-hmm. You could say revival, but this is his only play that never made it to Broadway, right?
That's right. It's finally making its Broadway debut, and directed by Ruben Santiago Hudson at Manhattan Theater Club. And it's one of, I mean, all his plays, all the 10 plays that make up the century cycle, I mean, as people may know, he wrote one play per decade of the 20th century. This is a really beloved play of his. It's set in Pittsburgh, like all of them, among unlicensed cab drivers known as jitney, you know, drivers. So it's about the it's a workplace drama about their lives.
And the acclaimed Broadway production of Fences with Denzel Washington and Viola Davis is now one of those Oscar-contending movies. Is this the first full feature film of his work, August Wilson?
You know, I should have an easy answer to that. I think it might be in terms of movies released theatrically. Of course, there have been versions of his plays filmed for TV, like American Playhouse back in the 80s on PBS. I think The Piano Lesson was broadcast, and as well as maybe I'm pretty sure that Fences must have been filmed with James Earl Jones and shown on TV.
Hmm.
But mm-hmm. This may be the first theatrical release of a movie, yeah.
January looks like it's especially rich for those who like downtown theater, with the Publix Under the Radar Festival and PS 122's Coil Festival, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really exciting. January used to be a sleepy time, but now Under the Radar, outside, which operates out of the Public Theater, brings all this exciting work, multidisciplinary work from around the country. Just looking here at the lineup, it's not a lot of names that people who, if you tend to just sort of go to Broadway or off-Broadway, you might not know these names, but Under the Radar is a great sort of tasting menu for experimental avant-garde work. And, you know, if your taste runs more toward musical theater and opera, there's, I think now in its fifth year, the Prototype Festival is really excellent, because that's a whole festival devoted over 2 weeks for new opera. But not, you know, not just the kind of opera you see at the Met. It's more chamber work, experimental work. I have to say, full disclosure, I'm also an opera librettist on the side, and so I presented work there in 2015. So, but it's a really excellent showcase.
Why Everything at Once, or it seems like Everything at Once, if those are all going on at the same time in January?
Well, there's something called the APAP, the Association of Presenters and Producers. It's a conference that happens every January in the city. So you have producers and presenters from around the world who just sort of binge on all number of shows, so that they can maybe invite them to the festivals in Europe or to their venues around the country. So it's a big showcase in the city in January.
Matchmakers between
playwrights
and people with money to produce the plays. What about new plays? One off-Broadway hit from this fall, Lynn Nottage's Sweat, is mm-hmm. moving uptown to Broadway in March. It's certainly topical about the loss of blue-collar jobs in a Pennsylvania town.
Yeah, though this play couldn't have been more right on. I mean, I think I reviewed it a couple weeks before the election, and it in retrospect, it had this, oh, that's what happened sort of feeling. It was just, it's a very beautiful play, very empathetic. I mean, besides its timeliness and its sort of social value, it's a very beautifully written play about people's lives, you know, on the edge when they are losing jobs, they're losing health coverage, they're losing their families. Lynn Nottage is one of our best playwrights, especially when it comes to dramatizing social issues, but not in a preachy way, but in a very humane, well-rounded way. So it's just a great sign that it's coming to... I mean, of course, the ticket prices might price out certain people who could see it, but I'm hoping that they'll find ways to have, you know, lower ticket prices for all sorts of people.
Now, this is award season for movies with all the Oscar contenders trying to be top of mind for the voters. And is there anything that's a parallel to that for theater? Is the new year when Tony contenders show up?
Yeah, generally. I mean, January, February, not so much. They tend to all cluster into March and April. The cutoff date for Tony eligibility is like the last week of April. So you see a lot of activity right around then. And, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, as you say, in these months, you get the real quality movies out of Hollywood, but it's not necessarily high quality that's vying for the Tony Awards. It's simply the splashiest and most, you know, most highest profile. For example, Hamilton opened in August, nearly 9 months before Tony time. So, you know, I guess you could say that was sort of a dare in some ways, because they figured that almost a year would pass and they'd still be the best show in town, and that was the case. Yeah, you'll see in March and April a lot of activity.
Are Hamilton tickets any more available in January than any other time?
It's possible. It depends what you're willing to pay. You know, I don't really pay close attention to that sort of end of the market, but it will be interesting to see when finally the market is saturated enough so that you don't have to wait, like, you know, 6 or 8 months to get a ticket.
We will have to leave it there for theater. Thank you, David Cote, Time Out New York's theater editor.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, winter comedy and music picks coming up next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now that it is really winter, you might be tempted to curl up on the couch with your trusty friend Netflix, but this is still New York, and if you can muster the energy and bundle yourself up in the puffy coat and part with some money, okay, it's not as cheap as Netflix, you can see some great live comedy this winter, and boy, do we need it with everything that's going on. Here with me now to tell you what's worth a night out in the winter is Jason Zinnemann, the New York Times On Comedy columnist and author of the forthcoming book, Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. Hi, Jason. Welcome to WNYC.
Great to be here.
So let me start with a clip. This is Chris Gethard. You've only got a few more chances to see his show, Career Suicide, which he made with the comedy powerhouse Judd Apatow. Here's a clip of the two of them. It's about a minute long, on a Skype call when the germ of the idea for Chris Gethard's show came about. Judd speaks first.
You know, this whole peak television thing, anytime I mention something, somebody gives me a show with a green light, yeah. You know, and the next thing you know, you got this like massive slate and you have no time for yourself. I haven't gotten to the Hawaii condo at all this year.
I'm in a pretty bad spot too, yeah. I just got cut out of the new Ghostbusters. I got cut from The Dictator as well.
Really?
I got cut from Iron Man 3.
It seems like a lot of the best people in town are cutting you out. So, I mean, all it takes is for one person not to cut you out for things to start falling together. I cut my daughter out of several films, and she was not happy about it.
We all got problems, man.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think it's weird to fly your kids private if you're not on the plane with them? Just, like, get them back from somewhere.
I'm just going to put this on the table very respectfully, if you don't mind, but I think our problems are maybe like a little different. I am a guy who doesn't really have much going on. Like, everyone I know has gotten successful, and I'm still hanging on in New York, and I see a shrink, and she's kind of nuts, and for a while I wasn't seeing a shrink, but I kept falling into these very bad spots where I was putting myself in danger, and sure, I can look back on it, and some of them are funny now, but, you know, I just kind of fight every day to keep my head on straight and keep myself healthy.
That actually sounds like a TV show.
Yeah.
All right. So
every comic's dream is to hear that from Judd Apatow.
That's right. Chris Kethard, who I think, you know, I was reading from my script before, and I think I just stated the two syllables of his name separately. So that could be, you know, somebody could riff on that themselves, but it's Kethard. And quoting from his website, the show is about suicide, depression, alcoholism, and all the other funniest parts of life. Ah, yes, the old comedy trifecta of suicide, depression, and alcoholism. Is that what comedy is coming to in this era?
It has, actually. I was just thinking about this. There's been a lot of comedy this year about death and suicide. In Louis's recent hour, he does some good stuff on suicide as well. It's not as fleshed out as Chris Cathard's show. But if you look at, like, Patton Oswalt's, turning the death of his wife into comedy. There are several other examples. I mean, there's comedy is arguably darker in mainstream forms than it's ever been. And in this case, you see another trend, which is that comedy is increasingly co-opting theater. He's moving into the theater space and putting on something that sort of can look like a one-man show, an autobiographical one-man show, but with jokes.
And his show, we should say, runs at the Lynn Redgrave Theater on Bleecker Street through January 8th. Two of your favorite young comics, I see, will be at Joe's Pub, January 31st through February 3rd, John Early and Kate Berlant. Is that it?
Berlant, right.
John Early is currently starting on the TBS show Search Party. What do you like about him?
John Early has stolen more scenes and cameos this year than almost anyone I could think of. I mean, he was on Broad City, Difficult People, Girls, and Search Party is probably his biggest part. And he's both of these artists are both incredibly talented kind of hybrids who are stand-up. They were, in Early's case, he sings. So his shows have a feeling of kind of cabaret at times. And Kate Berlant is a completely, I mean, there's nothing else like her. She sort of free associates and is kind of, she sort of pushes into experimental theater. And what they share is this absolute love of the silly. In a time when people are feeling a little down or depressed, sometimes the best medicine is something absurd and surreal, and that's them.
And she's so unusual that we pulled a clip, partly because she is hard to categorize. I read a piece where you said she doesn't really tell jokes, and that's part of her experimental comedy genre. So here is about a minute of Kate Berlant.
Do you guys steal? Who steals? So one person said no, so it's a coward right here somewhere. No one steals, just a room full of nerds. I steal in a very specific way. I believe 100% that women have the right to steal cosmetics. Completely. Thank you. Absolutely. The situation is women sometimes upon birth, are forced into an economy. You have to pay for your own subjectivity constantly, right? So if you don't have certain creams, powders, lotions, the state won't recognize you. You can't get a job, right? It's really, it's very violent, kind of the system. So I've taken to over the years just gradually stealing from, and by the way, I'm not talking about small ma and pa shops. Who here is a small business owner? Just so I know, that's what I thought, so relax. But I'm talking about Sephora, right? Same, yeah, really big chains, right? Those kind of are an anchor for me. For example, the red lipstick I'm wearing tonight, hey. It's called Scarlet Empress, and it costs $30 if you pay for it. And I won't.
Huh. Good example of Kate Berlant.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's always a moment in her, one of her monologues, where this kind of hyper-articulate intellectual voice turns into total nonsense and non sequitur. And that, it's sort of the, I mean, I would argue she doesn't write conventional jokes, and a lot of her work is improvisational, but there is that moment when it turns into nonsense is like a punchline for her.
And so to Chris Cathard's suicide, depression, and alcoholism as comedy themes, we can now add theft.
True, true.
Leslie Jones in the current cast of Saturday Night Live, of course, and she was in the Ghostbusters reboot from earlier this year, also famous for being harassed online by somebody associated with Breitbart. She's going to be at Caroline's February 23rd and 24th, so that looks ahead a little more. I read that Chris Rock told the Saturday Night Live executive producer, Lorne Michaels, that Leslie Jones is the funniest woman he knows.
Yeah, I mean, Leslie Jones joined Saturday Night Live after this controversy about Saturday Night Live not hiring enough black women. Mm-hmm. But actually, what is also very unusual about her is that she is older than most of the new Saturday Night Live cast members. And she's in her late 40s. And she had a long stand-up career before. And so what's exciting about this Caroline show is that people – she's kind of had a breakout now with Ghostbusters and SNL, where she's, you know, a ferociously charismatic performer. But her home, her original, where she made her bones, was in stand-up. And so she's doing that at Caroline's. And she's – I think there's a lot of advantages – to casting people on SNL who have that kind of experience.
Speaking of Chris Rock, he's heading out on his first world tour in 9 years, I see, but he won't be in our area until the end of March when he performs at a charity benefit. That's March 28th with a bunch of comedy all-stars, John Oliver, Tracy Morgan, Jerry Seinfeld, Leslie Jones. That'll be a steep ticket price, I'm sure. Where is that? What is it? Do you know?
That, I think it's a benefit. I would not be surprised if he, and I have no proof of this, but if he announces a Madison Square Garden date. He has a tour. It starts in February and it goes on for 4 months. And he starts in North Carolina and goes all over the country. And I would say the most conspicuous absence in stand-up comedy over most of the last decade has been the Chris Rock stand-up special. He's one of our greatest stand-ups, probably our greatest political stand-up. Yeah. And he hasn't had a special in 9 years. The last one was when during the Obama campaign, when Bush was in office. So what's he going to say about Trump? What's he going to say about Black Lives Matter? You know, I was recently watching his last special, and he has this one joke about McCain, which stood out for me, where he said, you know, he's talking about people say he's a war hero. He goes, he's a war hero that got captured. I don't want to lose the vote for expletive who got captured. I want to vote for the guy who got away. And it struck me because Trump said, of course, the exact same thing, which says something about how Chris Rock is one of the most politically trenchant comics out there, but he's unpredictable politically.
All right. We'll see if he schedules that New York date. And while we're on the subject of comedy superstars, Jerry Seinfeld, I see, is performing for a few nights at the Beacon Theater. It's the Upper West Side Beacon Theater in January, February, and March. I read a review of a Seinfeld performance in Chicago that called it somewhat stale. Is he worth a steep ticket price still?
I think he is. I mean, that was an interesting review. I think that was interesting because the critic was taking issue with the fact that he uses jokes that has had for, you know, for years and decades. And today, the kind of au courant thing is to do what Louis and George Carlin did, which was to throw away your material and start again after you do it. But Seinfeld, you know, he's become like the Billy Joel of comedy. You know, he's still has this mass appeal. He's reliably funny. And he plays the old hits. If anything, how he's changed, his stand-up has changed since the days of his show is, you know, he has more stuff about fatherhood now. He's not the cutting edge. He's not Cate Berlant, but he is still top of his game, really funny.
Somebody told me, by the way, that Billy Joel plays the Garden once a month and will continue to do so until one of his shows doesn't sell out. Do you know that to be true?
I didn't know the point about it, that not selling out. I've seen one of those shows, and he puts on, I mean, he plays those grit songs terrifically, and the audience loves him, and I can't see it not selling out. I mean, Billy Joel and Seinfeld are in New York institutions now.
We just have about a minute left. Let me get one or two more in here on our comedy preview. Big J Okerson. Now, my producer tried to find a clip to play of him, but everything we found would have required so many bleeps, it would have been incomprehensible. Does that sound about right?
That's exactly right. I think I once called him in the Times, who's not easy to write about in the Times, the poet laureate of the penis joke. He's you know, as clean as Jerry Seinfeld is, he is as dirty, but I think he's also a really gifted comic who's also one of the best out there at crowd work. You know, you'll see this in a lot of stand-up where someone will say, where are you from? You know, tell me, what do you do? And they use it as a transition. Well, Big J Okerson turns those conversations into the meat of the joke, and he creates incredibly freewheeling, wonderful comedy out of that.
And in our last few seconds, maybe we should remind everybody that if you can't get tickets to one of the shows of the big comedians that we've been talking about, there are plenty of places to see great comedy every single night here in the city, including some pretty big names who might show up unadvertised at relatively cheap ticket prices. What are some of the clubs?
Comedy Cellar is probably the most famous. The Stand is a great place to go. You could go to UCB to see Whiplash on Monday nights. And these are all relatively cheap, and you never know who's going to show up.
Is there a trick to finding out if Louis C.K. or Seinfeld or whoever might do a surprise set at a given small club on a given night that's unannounced?
One trick is if they have a big show, if Louis's got a Madison Square Garden, he's going to host Saturday Night Live the next day, you can count on the night before or the week before he's out in clubs. So that increases your chance a little bit.
Jason Zinnemann, the New York Times on comedy columnist and the author of the forthcoming book, Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. Come back and talk to us when the book comes out, okay?
I'd love to.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Somebody stole my car radio, and now I just sit in silence.
Wow, how many of those very diverse five pieces of music can you name, from the artist Mahler at the top to 21 Pilots, as we continue now with our winter culture season preview? What music will be worth bundling up and braving the cold to see and hear? No downloads here, just live performances that we'll talk about happening around town in January, February, or March. And I'm joined by WNYC's John Schaefer, the host of Soundcheck and New Sounds, who has brought a list of shows to catch this winter. And you've just heard a few snippets from some of the artists on his list. Hey, John.
Hi, Brian.
Let's start with a couple of festivals, because first up is the Winter Jazz Festival that runs from January 5th through 10th at venues all over the village.
Right. And while you can buy a festival pass, you can also sort of pick and choose and go to shows a la carte. And two that I would mention in particular, January 5th, Pharoah Sanders, who was an associate of John Coltrane and is one of the last men standing from that great generation of jazz sax players, and who does get to New York occasionally, but not often enough for the taste of fans like me. So he's playing January 5th. And January 9th, the Vermont folk singer Sam Amidon is doing what he calls Sam Amidon Extended, a kind of series of jazzy improvisations with people like guitarist Bill Frisell. And both of those events happen to be taking place at Le Poisson Rouge, which is one of the central parts of the Winter Jazz Fest.
And by the way, Pharoah Sanders was one of the artists in the montage.
That's right.
For people who might have recognized or not that very adventurous saxophone sound that he has. And then there's Global Fest at Webster Hall. Global music like this. Okay, John, what's this?
So this is an Estonian singer and fiddler named Marja Nuut, and she combines the sounds of traditional Estonian folk music with a sort of modern minimalist aesthetic, you know, the repeating string sounds of a Philip Glass or, you know, the echoes of the sounds of electronic dance music even. And so she is one of the artists playing at Global Fest on January 8th, which will also feature Gulla songs, you know, the traditional African-American songs of the Sea Islands off the coast of South Carolina and Georgia, the Afro-Portuguese DJ and producer Batida, and lots of others. And it all takes place at Webster Hall.
Let's listen to a little more of Marja Nuut. And she was also in the montage at the beginning. So I think we've covered them all now, because I gave away Mahler, which we'll get back to. And then the next one was Marja Nuut. Oh, Frank Turner. We didn't mention him yet, but we'll get there.
Yep.
Pharoah Sanders and 21 Pilots, which is the next one I want to ask you about, at Barclays Center on January 20th.
Right, which is an indication of just how big this duo from Ohio has gotten, that they are playing the Barclays Center, and I expect they will fill the Barclays Center.
There's a little taste for those of you who aren't in that group yet. This is 21 Pilots.
Car Radio.
I think we've got that.
Yeah, it's from a couple of years back, but it's a great song from the band 21 Pilots.
To pick one, please, because faith is to be a
awake, and to be awake is for us to think, and for us to think is to be alive. And I will try with every rhyme to come across like I am dying to let you know you need to try to think. I have these thoughts so often I ought to replace that slot.
So they got the name of the band from an Arthur Miller play, I see.
Yeah, All My Sons. I mean, it's kind of a dark name for a band, this idea that, you know, one person doing the easy thing as opposed to doing a good job caused the death of 21 pilots. But, you know, so this is a band that has gotten it right numerous times. Their current record, called Blurry Face, has spawned a couple of hit songs.
A few more seconds. Some of the bigger names in February, moving on to February now, include Drive-By Truckers, a southern rock band with progressive politics, Frank Turner at the Beacon Theater, Darlene Love at B.B. King's Blues Club,
right,
and the Kronos Quartet at Zankel Hall. Here's a little Drive-By Truckers.
That among the fallen was tradition, that tradition was the mission.
Tell us about this band.
Yeah, so Drive-By Truckers, their album is called American Band, which you could take as an ironic or even sarcastic title. The album is full of kind of angry, progressive politics. You know, Black Lives Matter is referenced in several songs. The death of Trayvon Martin is referenced clearly in one particular compelling song. This song is Surrender Under Protest, and it is basically a call to arms. Now, they are playing twice here, and I mention that because they're in Westbury, Long Island on February 10th. They're at Webster Hall here in town on the 11th.
Uh-huh.
And the 11th is a tough day because that's also when Darlene Love is playing, as you said, at B.B. King's, and it's also when Kronos is playing at Zankel Hall. So you're going to have some tough choices to make that
only
evening.
In New York, right?
Yeah, right.
So what are they – because I'm not familiar with them. Are they like – is this like Lynyrd Skynyrd music meets the politics of Kanye West?
That's actually not a bad way of putting it, Brian. They are a southern rock band who are sick and tired of the kind of tradition that has accrued to southern rock bands, you know, the Confederate flags and all that kind of stuff. And that song we were just hearing, Surrender Under Protest, is about how tradition is something that you need to get out from under if you're going to move forward.
Of course, Kanye maybe was not the perfect analogy there, since he didn't vote and then said he would have voted for Trump. Just for the record. But other things that he said and done. Another one, Frank Turner at the Beacon Theater. Let's listen to a little bit.
I'm still having dreams. And on the worst days, when it feels like life weighs.
All right. Hearing big sound 80s pop here.
Well, which is funny because Frank Turner is a British folk punk artist. If you're familiar with Billy Bragg, he's in that lineage. But the songs do have this kind of explosive quality occasionally, as in this one, which is called I Am Disappeared.
And come morning, I am disappeared. Just an imprint on the bedsheets.
The variety is staggering.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of great music out there, and it all seems to make its way to New York at some point or another.
Darlene Love at B.B. King Blues Club.
Right. Darlene Love, you may have seen her in the film 20 Feet from Stardom, the documentary about backup singers. Darlene Love was one of the main voices in Phil Spector's sonic arsenal.
Boy, it's 1961 again.
Yeah, and to call her a backup singer does her a real disservice, because she's clearly front and center in A Fine, Fine Boy, as she was in so many of Phil Spector's hits. It took a long time for Darlene Love's name to start to get the recognition that she has long deserved.
We are previewing the winter music season with WNYC's John Schaefer for just another couple of minutes. Continuing to go down the list, the Kronos Quartet, they're always up to something interesting.
Right.
At Zankel Hall, which is part of Carnegie Hall.
They present a program that includes some works commissioned specifically by them for the ensemble, younger artists, and, you know, a real diversity of composers of many different races, creeds, and colors. They have really blown apart the idea of what a string quartet can look like and sound like.
And on the classical music front, the New York Philharmonic is on your list, too.
Well, they're doing a program March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. So you have three opportunities to see this at Avery Fisher Hall, where they're premiering a violin concerto by Lera Auerbach, a New York-based artist, a composer whose music I think is really extraordinary, paired with the Mahler Fourth Symphony. Now, this is Mahler in an unaccustomed, sunny role. You know, a lot of his music is pretty heavy.
Almost Mahler as Stravinsky.
It's got the jingle bells going and stuff. It's a really nice sound. I also want to mention something that's a little bit off the beaten track, Brian, and that is Othello the Remix, which is, there's been a lot of talk about hip-hop on Broadway and, hip-hop and a certain historical figure on Broadway. And this Othello the Remix, it is a genuine retelling of the story of Shakespeare's Othello, but the big remix is not that it's set in the world of hip-hop, although it is, it's that they have recast it as a comedy. And to give you an idea of what Othello the Remix, what the Q Brothers, what their sort of level of comedy sounds like, Here's them referencing that certain historical figure.
Hamilton. Did you hear about the Hamilton? Cubs won the world. Hamilton. Trump is the Hamilton. Whatever. Othello the Remix, we just trying to keep the lights on. Like a rapping blue man group meets Monty Python. It's short, it's fun, and it's fly. And if you buy a ticket to our show, I can save up for the cash to buy a ticket to Hamilton. So I can see Hamilton. And when everybody talks about Hamilton, I can talk about Hamilton.
That's fun.
And Othello the Remix, it is cheaper than Hamilton, funnier than Hamilton, shorter than Hamilton. 80 minutes, no intermission at the West Side Theater through March 5th.
And you can get tickets.
You can get in.
We will have to leave it there. We thank John Schaefer. Be sure and catch John's shows on stage, on podcast, and on the radio. We will be hearing about cultural offerings for the new season in other arts all week. Let's hear a little from Goran Bregovic. To go out on. You want to talk about this a little as we start it?
Goran Bregovic, from the former Yugoslavia, based in Paris, best known for his film scores like the movie Underground. He leads his wedding and funeral band. Those are the big musical occasions in the former Yugoslavia. And he'll be at Carnegie Hall on March 8th.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hope you enjoyed our theater, art, comedy, and music picks. Here's to more great conversations with all of you in 2017. Thanks for listening today, and Happy New Year.